Hey, Carson, Doug calling in for a sound check.
Hey, thanks, Doug. Mic check.
Sounds good.
Mic check, 1, 2, 3.
1, 2, 3, good.
Testing, 1, 2, 3.
Testing, 1, 2, good.
Testifier mic 1.
Good.
And testifier mic 2.
Good.
And Senator Olson's mic.
Senator Olson's mic, good.
Senator Von Imhoff.
Von Imhoff, good.
Senator Stedman.
Stedman, good.
And Chair Mic 1.
Chair Mic 1, good.
And last one.
Last one, good.
Awesome. Thanks, Doug.
Great meeting. Bye-bye. Thanks.
Good morning. We're going to call the Senate Finance Committee to order. Today is Tuesday, March 30th, 2021, and the time is 9 a.m. Please silence all cell phones. Carson and Allison, thank you for being here this morning. Present Senator Stedman, Senator Von Himhoff is on telephonically, Senator Olson likewise. Senator Wilikowski will be along as he's here. Sorry, Senator, I didn't see you. Senator Wilson, Senator Hoffman, myself, Senator Bishop, and thanks to all staff members here present. Today's agenda, SB56/HB76, extending the COVID-19 disaster emergency. This is the second hearing of HB76. We will hear invited testimony and public testimony. If the testimony runs over, we have the time. For the time we have scheduled, we may recess and come back to finish everyone's testimony. But for now, my intention is to hear and hold 76 today. Invited testimony is between 3 and 5 minutes for an invited testimony. And first up is Jared Cosen. Jared, are you there? And if you are, put yourself on the record and introduce yourself. And the floor is yours.
For the record, my name is Jared Cosen, and I am the president and CEO of the Alaska State Hospital and Nursing Home Association. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today. ASHNA strongly supports House Bill 76. As we stated on the record before, Alaska's hospitals and nursing homes view the disaster declaration as a legal mechanism that provides tools and resources to combat COVID-19. Now, this is a well-debated issue, and I understand the sentiment that, you know, we cannot live in fear or the emergency, the crisis point, has passed. Our position as healthcare providers is this is not about fear or crisis. It's about being practical. These tools give Alaska a heightened defense through airport testing. They give the state financial support through the SNAP program, and they give Alaskans easier access to care during uncertain times through telehealth. To us in the healthcare sector, these issues alone warrant carrying House Bill 76 forward with the disaster declaration. However, if there is still doubt, I have one other observation to share. I regularly communicate with my counterparts in the lower 48, who are association heads from across the country. On Sunday, I received a message from my colleague in Michigan. Michigan is experiencing a case surge. As of Sunday, they had 2,074 COVID hospitalizations in the month of March. They were well below 1,000 for most of February. Per a news report, the average case rate and positivity rates in Michigan are the highest they've been since mid-December. And over the first 3 weeks in March, hospitalizations increased by 633% for adults ages 30 to 39 and 800% for adults 40 to 49. I'm sure these statistics can be picked apart every which way, and they probably will be. But the message here is not a fear and that Alaska is next. Rather, this is a reminder that we are so close to being through this. And if you were asking for the healthcare industry's perspective, we would offer a question. With variants and the ability for case surges to ebb and flow, as evidenced by Michigan, why would we limit our tools and resources now? Our answer is we would not. We urge you to pass House Bill 76, and thank you for your time.
Thank you for your testimony. Next, we're going to Dr. Elliot Bruhl, Southeast Alaska Regional Consortium. Dr. Bruhl, can you hear us?
I hear you just fine.
Thank you. Put yourself on the record, and thanks for calling in, sir.
Thank you for including me in testimony for this bill. I'm Dr. Elliot Bruhl. I'm the Chief Medical Officer and Senior Vice President for the Southeast Alaska Regional Health Consortium. I've practiced medicine in Southeast Alaska for nearly 30 years have been working over the last year extremely hard along with our staff to help keep Southeast Alaska safe The issue of the emergency status has been very important to our efforts to keep people safe. There's a number of issues that we're standing on the threshold of our new season, and although the cruise ships aren't going to be coming to Southeast Alaska, we do hope for and expect all of the growth of economic activity around fishing and fishing charters and small lodge work, and look forward to supporting our communities with that. We've been successful in providing over 12,000 vaccinations, or vaccinating over 12,000 people in the region in the last few months. And with the ongoing pandemic in the lower 48, we're anticipating people coming into the region and the potential for reigniting the pandemic here because of this flow of people in. The emergency order would allow for mandatory airport testing, which really is a key element of keeping our communities safe. Additionally, we have patients who have relationships with specialists outside the state. For example, cancer patients who have relationships with oncologists, say in Seattle, and without the emergency order, ability to have those relationships continued is cut off from a telehealth standpoint. That's something that needs to be addressed. And we also have patients who are receiving medically assisted treatment, which requires the subscription of Suboxone for treatment of their opiate addictions. And this is a really important part of our practice in terms of supporting our communities and making them safe, and having people with these addictions not continue to use opiates. The emergency order allows us to continue to do that using telehealth, and without it, that's not possible. Those are just a few examples of very pragmatic health-based activities that are enabled by the emergency order.
Thank you, Dr. Brewer. We have a question. Senator Stedman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Dr. Brewer, I was just wondering if CERCH has a position on having testing done at our airports in Southeast to help alleviate the transfer of this virus, either from up north in the Anchorage area coming south or from Seattle coming north.
Well, we do have a position, and that testing is a key element of maintaining safe communities. So people who are coming in who are fully vaccinated, there's more information that has come out just in the last 24 hours, additional papers published and available on the CDC website that show that the vaccines are not only effective at preventing disease that would put you in the hospital, but are 90% effective at preventing transmissible asymptomatic disease. This is very exciting. It really shows the effectiveness of vaccines, and we really feel that coming into the coming season, we can test people who are coming in who are not vaccinated, and for those who are unvaccinated, we have such strong supplies of vaccine that we're excited about being able to support our fishing industry by vaccinating their staff as they come in. So, you know, working collaboratively with them. But testing is a key element of being able to do that.
Thank you. Next, we're going to go to Phil Hofstetter, the Petersburg Medical Center. Can you hear us, Phil?
Yep. Can you hear me okay?
Yes. Please state your name for the record and continue with your testimony.
Thank you for the opportunity to testify. For the record, I am Phil Hofstetter, CEO of Petersburg Medical Center, and I'm testifying in support of the emergency declaration, Hospital 76. Petersburg Medical Center is a critical access hospital on the island community of Petersburg in southeast. We have a population of roughly around 3,200. Our hospital has 12 inpatient beds, 15 long-term care, ER, home health, outpatient, primary care. So I've testified in support of emergency declaration at the House Health and Social Services in early March as well. Our staff, like Dr. Brule mentioned, we're working very hard to address COVID in the past year, and we've assisted in the community response with asymptomatic testing, airport testing. Our staff helped set up the point of dispensing for vaccine distribution. We helped a respiratory clinic for those with symptomatic COVID. We physically have gone to businesses, the seafood industry, schools, assisted living, to help with asymptomatic testing programs, and we work closely with our borough emergency operations to assist in COVID response. We are very proud to keep our cases low in the past year. We kept businesses open and schools open until this outbreak. And I did provide a graph to the committee. I don't know if you received it, but it depicts the whole year of the COVID response. And you can see that with the expiration of the declaration in February, pretty soon after, we saw this tremendous spike of over 68 cases within about 10 days. Our total number of cases exceeded 100. And we saw with the expiration of the declaration, a lot of folks not just passing by the airport testing. And once the mandates became recommendations and advisory, they just weren't as effective. Once it bypassed the airport and came into the community, we saw spread with restaurants, bars, daycares, and schools. And our response was very traumatic. We had to shut businesses and schools down for 2 to 3 weeks. We had to increase incredible efforts with our staff to test. We also did vaccinations as well during the outbreak. We saw people become sicker. We had inpatient admissions. Home health was monitoring patients. We had monoclonal antibody treatments. We had long recovery times. This was pretty considerable and very, very taxing on our staff and the community. And so we very much support testing at the airport. We feel like there should be a strong effort to make sure that people entering the community are tested and do not have COVID. And I feel like the state emergency declaration will help support that. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Hofstetter, for your testimony. Senator Stebbins has a question.
Just got to get me rigged up here, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm looking at the chart on the second page of the chart, and it looks like there's roughly 124 people on there that tested positive, and there was four fully vaccinated positives and three first dose positives. Could you help us understand that a little bit more?
It's exactly as it says. We were able, of the whole outbreak, there's two things that it shows. One, that the majority of people that had COVID were unvaccinated. And two, it does show that if you're fully vaccinated, that it's still possible to get COVID. The symptoms were minimal, and obviously, the idea of the vaccines to prevent people to come into the hospital and getting severe COVID. And I know, as Dr. Brule mentioned, it does help with preventing transmission. We understand that now. But it's not 100%. I think that's what it shows, and I think that also expresses the importance of testing, not just vaccinations, but testing and vaccination in combination.
Thank you. Senator Hoffman?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. But we've had reports that when you're vaccinated, although you may get positive, you have immunity 100% and will not be hospitalized. Is that the case that you understand?
You know, it's. I think that's what we're seeing right now. I don't know if you know. Again, anything's 100%. I believe the vaccines were to help prevent severe COVID.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Stedman?
Let me rephrase that. Maybe you didn't hear the question. There's seven people on the chart, that three that had the first dose, four that had the second dose. Did any of those seven people, were they hospitalized or were they just quarantined at home when Petersburg dealt with this issue?
Yeah, none of them were hospitalized. There were some symptoms, you know. I hesitate to go into specific details, but there are symptoms. None were hospitalized, correct.
Follow up.
And could you, do you know what vaccine the seven people had? Was it Pfizer or Moderna or?
At that time, the only ones that were available were Pfizer and Moderna.
Okay. Any more questions? Seeing none, thank you, Mr. Hofstetter. Next, we're going to go to Mr. Strickland with Peace Health.
Hello, my name is Tim Strickland. I'm the Director of Government Affairs for Peace Health Ketchikan Medical Center, and I am grateful for the opportunity to share just a couple of thoughts in addition to those that have already been shared. I would like to reiterate for the committee that the frontline healthcare workers and the doctors and the healthcare leadership have been on the front line of the pandemic from the very beginning and have been very grateful from the beginning for the protections that were provided in SB 241, which was passed by the legislature and signed into law last year. And keep in mind that the emergency declaration allowed hospitals and other providers to establish alternate sites of care and created greater flexibility to ensure the well-being not only of caregivers and of guests and patients, but particularly to stop the spread or at least to slow the spread of the virus. So an example of that would be an alternate site of care that would not traditionally be used for inpatient care, but was set up as a COVID-specific unit so that we could cohort patients who were known to be COVID positive so that it would help prevent the spread of the virus through the rest of the hospital, and special protocols in place to ensure the prevention of the spread of the virus among caregivers and other staff. So some of these alternate sites of care and other changes in our traditional clinical protocols were made possible by the emergency declaration. And there is also a liability protection component of SB 241 that reads, except as provided in D of this section, a public health agent or healthcare provider who takes action based on a standing order issued by the chief medical officer is not liable for civil damages resulting from an act or omission in implementing the standing order. It goes on to say that this does not constitute a waiver of negligence or any kind of intentional misconduct. It's appropriate, it's narrow, it's targeted. And so providers who have been acting in good faith to comply with government guidance under the protection provided by the state now feel to some degree at risk of exposure while continuing to act in good faith, even though the emergency declaration has expired. We believe that there may be some cover from the federal emergency declaration, and we continue to do the right thing for the right reasons. But there is a sense of vulnerability now on the part of these people who have been serving on the front lines. So the emergency declaration would provide the additional appropriate protections for hospitals, hospital workers, doctors, nurses, anyone who is on the front line of providing care during this pandemic. And we ask for, we certainly support renewing the emergency declaration and ask for your support for that. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions from committee members? Seeing none, thank you for your testimony, sir. And next we're going to go to Fairbanks to Kara Dewar, Director of Public Engagement, Food Bank of Alaska. Can you hear us?
I can. Thank you. For the record, my name is Kara Durr, and I am the Director of Public Engagement for Food Bank of Alaska, based in Anchorage, by the way. Thanks for the opportunity to testify in support of HB 76. For my part, I'm going to focus on a big area of concern for the food bank and our partners related to the public health emergency declaration, which is the potential loss of SNAP emergency allotments. Failure to extend the disaster declaration or something comparable will result in the loss of these emergency allotments, which provide critical 100% federally funded benefit boosts to individuals in need. During the pandemic, hunger has increased dramatically. Map the Meal Gap, which is a research project of Feeding America, estimates that food insecurity in Alaska has increased 32% in 2020. Looking at children specifically, hunger has increased 44%. Areas of the state that had high rates of food insecurity previously, such as rural areas like Bethel and the Northwest Arctic, continue to see increased need. The Kasilvek census area has emerged as the most food insecure region of the country for kids during the pandemic. And on the other side of the coin, we've seen areas that tend to have lower rates of food insecurity, including much of Southeast Alaska, experience huge increases. Skagway and Sitka, for example, have seen an estimated 72% and 55% increase, respectively, in child food insecurity during the pandemic. To meet these needs, Food Bank of Alaska and our over 150 agency partners statewide have worked incredibly hard to source and distribute more food than ever before. Food Bank distributed 43% more pounds of food in the last 6 months of 2020 compared with the same time frame in 2019. And things don't seem to be slowing down for us, as we've had record numbers within multiple programs just in the last few months. With the current high level of need that we're seeing, we are deeply concerned about what the loss of SNAP emergency allotments could mean for food insecurity in Alaska and for the additional burden their loss would place on the already stretched-thin charitable food network. SNAP benefits in Alaska are calculated based on household size, income, expenses or deductions, and geographic region. SNAP emergency allotments supplement existing SNAP benefits by providing all individuals and families with the maximum benefit level for their household size. For example, a single person in Anchorage could have their benefits bumped up from roughly $20 a month to $251 a month through emergency allotments. We see a lot of seniors and disabled individuals receive just the minimum benefit and know that this vulnerable group has greatly benefited from these boosts. While I can't overemphasize the importance of these benefits to individuals receiving them, they also have broader positive economic impact. Moody's Analytics estimates that in a weak economy, every dollar in SNAP benefits yields $1.70 in local economic activity. So $8 million a month translates to $13.6 million in economic activity. That's money that's spent at local grocery stores and money that flows back into struggling communities as well as helping families meet their nutrition needs. These emergency allotments are 100% federal benefit boost worth about $8 million each month, which is the equivalent of over 2.2 million meals. To put this into perspective, Food Bank of Alaska, with our very heightened current numbers, distributes about 750,000 meals a month. Clearly, if we lose these emergency allotments while the need is still so high, we can't even start to fill this gap. These benefits are an essential tool in our state's hunger response toolkit, and the nonprofit Anti-Hunger Network is depending on the legislature to allow these benefits to continue as long as the option is available to us. It's important to note that while an alternative option does exist to preserve the emergency allotments, it would also require legislation to give the specific authority to the state using language approved by USDA Food and Nutrition Services. Given that we are rapidly approaching the April 1st extension deadline that USDA has granted, my concern around delaying this process further is the impact on families who are depending on and expecting these benefits. Not only is there a clear financial impact that struggling families will experience if they don't receive these benefits as expected, but we also need to consider the stress and confusion that comes with a sharp decrease in benefits without notice or time to plan. I would strongly encourage the committee to move forward with this bill, which provides the clearest path to continuing these critical benefits without interruption or delays for families who are depending on them. Thank you.
Ms. Durr, could you provide that testimony to the committee? You gave some, there's some great information there, and I have a little trouble hearing. And if you feel inclined, I'd appreciate it if you'd send that to the committee. And Senator, go ahead.
Sorry, yes. happy to do that.
Thank you. Senator Wilikowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for that testimony. Do you have a rough sense of how many Alaskans take advantage of the enhanced SNAP benefits?
Senator Wilikowski, through the chair, I don't have specific numbers, but we know that nationally about 60% of families qualify for the emergency allotment, so meaning they're not receiving the maximum allotment already. Again, I think that the department could probably provide those numbers, but if I was to extrapolate from that, I would say it would be about 44,000.
Senator Wilikowski, we do have Deputy Commissioner Wall on the line, if you'd like to direct that question to him.
I would, yeah. We asked that the other day, and I'm waiting back for an answer. I think that's important to know. If the Deputy Commissioner knows that, that'd be good information, I think.
Commissioner Wall, are you online?
I am, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Did you hear Senator Wilikowski's question, or do we need to restate the question?
I believe he asked how many individuals or how many families took advantage of the SNAP emergency allotment. Is that correct?
He's yes. Nodding his head yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Albert Wall. I'm Deputy Commissioner of Department of Health and Social Services. I do believe that there is a draft response being sent to the committee. The number does change a little bit every month, so I'm going to give you about an average. It's about 34,000 households on an average.
Thank you. Senator Wilikowski, any follow-up?
Well, just on the timing of the payout, I know, again, that's something we asked, but is that all paid out like on a weekly basis, or what is the timing of that? Those payouts?
Senator Wilikowski, through the chair, that is a monthly basis, and it begins to be processed on the first of the month. They don't all go out on the same day because they have to be individually processed. So it happens over time.
Thank you, Commissioner Wall. Next, we're going to go to Lisa Aquino, Catholic Services of Alaska, Catholic Social Services of Alaska at Anchorage. Are you online?
Yes, I am. Thank you.
Please state your name for the record and continue with your testimony. Thank you.
Thank you, and thank you so much for hearing me today. My name is Lisa Aquino, and I am the CEO of Catholic Social Services, and I'm here to testify in support of HB 76. I'm really here today to make sure that I bring up and that I'm speaking for vulnerable people in our state. You know, the marginalized and the vulnerable are the most impacted by health issues like COVID, and the extending the public health disaster emergency will protect them, and they are our hardest to protect. So I just, you know, I'm following the Food Bank of Alaska, who did a wonderful job of explaining how important SNAP benefits are in this emergency. Currently, Alaska SNAP recipients are eligible to receive emergency allotment of benefits contingent on the state public health emergency declaration. But if the legislature does not extend the governor's ability to declare a public health emergency, the state's at risk of losing an additional $8 million in benefits that's currently coming to Alaskans. These benefits not only support Alaskan families, but they also bolster local economies. Losing these benefits would impact not only Alaskans facing food insecurity, but communities at large. Catholic Social Services operates one of the largest food pantries in the state of Alaska here in Anchorage. Our food pantry has seen an increased demand in the pandemic. We saw that demand increase immediately, and it's fluctuated a bit, but it's remained really high. One out of four families who access our pantry visit multiple times throughout the month. They did that in January. They've been doing that every month because they simply can't get by. Prior to the pandemic, we served on average about 70 households each day. Now we're serving 100 households each day. And I want to thank and commend the Food Bank of Alaska for assuring and working to have food available to our incredible donors who've been donating food, but it's not enough. SNAP alleviates great strain on food pantries and the food bank. It's only together that we can truly knit a safety net that can help vulnerable Alaskans. And I just want to say there's other issues involved with the public health disaster and having that declaration that protect vulnerable people. One important thing that might not be obvious is that currently being covered for that telehealth is being covered for Medicaid recipients, and that goes away. That's really important because a lot of people in the state who are on Medicaid are working in frontline jobs and are at high risk. Having the ability to access health care through telehealth allows them to keep working and to prevent more people from being at risk. It's a really important tool, and it might seem like such a simple one, but it makes an enormous difference. And there's so many small things like that. I'm just here to represent the thousands of people that we serve, and so many of them are working really high-risk, dangerous jobs, and having a public health emergency declared further protects them as they're cleaning hospital rooms, as they're working the front line at grocery stores, and I ask you to please strongly consider supporting House Bill 76. Thank you so much for this opportunity.
Thank you. Senator Wilikowski has a question.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just curious, TAMF benefits, temporary assistance for needy families, how is that different than SNAP benefits, and is that affected by this disaster declaration, do you know?
Well, I'm not an expert on how the benefits are all different, so I think it would be important to speak to ask maybe the department about that. But what I do know is that TAMF stands for Temporary Assistance for Needy Families. And typically, every summer, those rates are cut in half for two-parent households with the reasoning that there's more jobs available. But I think we all know that that's not the summer we're expecting this summer, and it's not the summer that we had last year. With this economy, I think cutting TAMF benefits in the summer is going to have really strong consequences for struggling families who are just trying to get by. These are families that have multiple jobs and that count on seasonal work in the summer, and that seasonal work isn't going to be there. I know that the commissioner of DHSS last summer did not cut TAMF in half, and I hope that that is what the decision will be this summer again, because it makes a huge difference for working families. Thank you.
Follow up.
Mr. Chair, if we have Deputy Commissioner Wall in the line, if we could just get some clarification on that, because I've had that issue raised to my office just on the potential impact of TAMF benefits by a disaster declaration or not having a disaster declaration.
Deputy Commissioner Wall, Senator Wilikowski had a question on the TANF benefits. Did you hear that?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I believe I did. This is, for the record, this is Albert Wall, Deputy Commissioner of the Department of Health and Social Services. As I heard it, there's basically two questions. One, what's the difference between SNAP and TANF? And then two, were the TANF benefits or the affected by the public health emergency? The basic difference in my understanding between SNAP and TANF is that SNAP benefits are considered an entitlement program, meaning anyone who needs food assistance can receive it for as long as they need it, while TANF is a temporary assistance and deliberately so, meaning it's time delimited. There are some other differences, including a fairly complex, who's eligible for what. List, and I would prefer to get that in writing to you because it's a little dense. So I can do that. Were they affected by the disaster declaration on the state level? The answer to that is no. And I'm speaking to Pan.
Okay, thank you. And if you could get back with some more detail, as you alluded to the committee, so we can get it just distributed to the committee members, it would be appreciated.
Certainly. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yes. Next. Oh, you had one more follow-up, Senator?
I just want to clarify again, because this has been raised to my office. So your testimony is that this potential disaster declaration will have no impact on future TANF benefits for Alaskans?
Senator Relikowski, through the chair, that is my understanding, yes.
Thank you.
All right, good. Thank you. Next, we're going to go to Ms. Wolf with the 4-acre group. And if you can hear us, please put your name on the record and proceed with your testimony.
Hi, can you hear me?
We can.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. For the record, my name is Lori Wolf. I'm president and CEO of the 4-Acre Group, which serves as the state nonprofit association for Alaska. As a voice for the nonprofit sector, I appreciate the opportunity to speak before the committee. My testimony will mirror my previous invited testimony on House Bill 76 in front of the House Health and Social Services Committee and House Finance. I join my colleagues from across the state in support of a renewed disaster declaration to ensure that we can continue to address the public health crisis and keep our economy moving forward. While there may still be hope on our horizon, we are not there yet. My analogy still stands in the situation that ending the declaration at this point is akin to stopping your penicillin 7-day regime 3 days early because you're starting to feel better. The science and experts would not support that action as it creates unnecessary risk, and worse yet, we might have to start over. We simply must stick to our prescription. Like you, we are hearing from nonprofits that need more certainty in order to meet the essential needs of all Alaskans right now. Simply put, we need to ensure the availability of widespread testing for Alaskans and mandatory testing for travelers into our state to protect our health and our economy. We need accessible vaccinations delivered efficiently and equitably statewide, and we need the ability to provide direct health care and critical social services through telehealth, and we need to protect our food security safety net through SNAP, as you just heard. All of these issues must remain a top priority if we want to focus on the intersection of public health and our economy. I recognize that at least some of these issues in the emergency declaration are being contemplated in separate pieces of legislation in both the House and Senate, but taking each item one by one, day by day, puts all Alaskans at risk unnecessarily and burdens nonprofits, local governments, and you, the state, who are responsible for the daily safety and care of every Alaskan. In short, extending the disaster declaration is essential to continuing to support the nonprofit sector, local governments, and all of us in not only responding to the global pandemic, but in establishing a solid foundation for what we all acknowledge will be a long journey of recovery. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today. 4-Acre stands ready to support you in your efforts. Thank you for your service.
Thank you. Questions from committee members to Ms. Wolf? Seeing none, we're going to go to Mr. Andreessen with the Alaska Municipal League.
Thank you, chairs and committee, for this opportunity to testify in your consideration of HB 76. For the record, my name is Nils Andreessen, Executive Director of the Alaska Municipal League. AML's membership is comprised of Alaska's cities and boroughs. Over the last year, Alaska's local governments have diverted a large amount of their attention to disaster response and management, to responding to the needs of their residents and businesses, and to fill the gap where the state wasn't acting at the local level. Without a state declaration in place, or with, if it is extended, local governments remain committed to acting in support of the state's public health, residents' public welfare, and the rebound of Alaska's economy. The loss of the declaration means that local governments have been scrambling to fill holes created in the absence of the state's declaration. Many declarations were tied to the states and have either been renewed or are now expired. Many have had to reconsider their own travel, quarantine, and testing restrictions. Many are in the midst of operating testing or vaccination clinics with questions about available resources, training, and authorities. Some have been racing to address spikes in cases. Many are looking at an uncertain future with new strains or variants, supporting vulnerable residents, preparing for an economic recovery, or preparing for the lack thereof. Ultimately, it's the uncertainty that ends up most challenging. A state government that's responsive and capable, at the very least, assists local governments in stabilizing their current operating environment. That means while state and local officials charged with public welfare continue to try and respond to the public health needs of our communities and to take necessary action that support economic recovery, a declaration remains just a tool at our disposal. The Alaska Disaster Act, which within HB 76 is really just sections 2 and 3, allows the state to allocate, distribute, and manage scarce resources, much of this in cooperation with and at the request of local governments, suspend regulations that may prevent or impede the provision of health services or COVID response, including many that businesses and organizations have depended on to ensure continued operations. It allows DMVA and DHSS to work together within the unified command structure, which is met weekly or biweekly with our members, and allows coordination with FEMA on non-congregate shelters, which is also intersected with municipal assets. For the purposes of this committee's review, as it relates to the financial impacts to the state's budget, it's worth highlighting that FEMA reimbursement is currently being met at 100% by the federal government, that multiple agencies have issued zero fiscal notes, and that additional federal assistance is on its way. Actions taken under the declaration are very likely to be covered by federal resources, and resources may be better leveraged with the declaration in place. The Alaska Disaster Act allows the state to act quickly and efficiently in response to a disaster. That includes the ability to move resources to where they're needed most. If we want to be open for business, local governments need a state whose emergency powers are fully employed on behalf of exactly that. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Andreessen, for that testimony. Now it appears that we are finished with invited testimony, and we're going to go to public testimony. So first up is Chris Eichenlaub in Wasilla, then Mike Coons will be in the queue in Palmer. So, Chris, if you could put yourself on the record in 2 minutes, please.
Okay, this is Chris Eichenlaub calling from Wasilla, Alaska. You copy me good?
We do.
Okay. Yeah, I'm going to be in opposition to this bill, SB 76, for many reasons. Number one, I'm testifying on behalf of myself and my grandchildren and all the other people's grandchildren that are at work that can't be doing this. But, you know, we're really wasting our resources, and we've been mismanaging them for quite some time. And this money that's going to all these nonprofits and everybody that's calling you, all the lobbyists that just talk, I mean, pretty much those are the takers. Now you're going to hear from the givers, the people that actually have to pay the bill. That, you know, sometimes you guys think it's free money because it's federal. You know, my grandchildren are going to pay for that, you know, regardless. So we got to weigh this out. We got to get our calculator out and say, really, are these programs worth what we're paying? I mean, if I'm going to buy somebody a box lunch, you don't even know how much you're paying for it. Why don't you just give them their statutory PFD, and most of these people could take care of their own needs. They could get their own experimental shot, buy their own masks, do all their own stuff, and get them out of this big rut we're in. You know, I can't see spending money on things that are proven not to work. I mean, you're swallowing people, and they got false positives, false negatives, and you don't even know if it's working. Even if it does, you're in the airport, you swab them, they get on an airplane, go somewhere else, you call them 3 days later and say, oh, yeah, you got COVID. Well, how many people are they exposed to? Did it really help? Those masks you guys are wearing, I'm looking at them, and I see Senator Wilson's probably the only one there, maybe Senator Bishop got one that may work. I mean, a little bit. So it's kind of like, you know, some of the things we're doing, I mean, we're not really weighing out the risk versus the reward. I mean, we're paying a lot of money to help somebody not get a virus, supposedly, that's, you know, 99.97% recoverable, you know, and it doesn't seem like it's a big waste of funds. So that's what I got for you guys, and I recommend that this thing is terrible. Not only that, just give the people their statutory PFD, and we'll see how they can buy their own box lunch for, you know, pennies on the dollar what these organizations are getting. I mean, these people are making six figures, you know, trying to help people with a five-cent lunch.
Thank you for your testimony, and we appreciate it. Have a good day. Next up is Mike Coons from Palmer. Please put yourself on the record in 2 minutes, sir.
Yes, this is Mike Coons. Do you hear me fine?
Oh, we read you loud and clear. Thank you.
Okay, appreciate it. My name is Mike Coons. I'm speaking for myself as an Alaskan senior whose demographics as seniors were hit the hardest with this pandemic. Although I supported continuing the emergency order originally, the EO has expired. Seniors have gotten their vaccines, therapeutics, and care needed, and are still being delivered. Airport testing is optional individually or at the city's determination. HB 76 is just creating a precedence for future governors to use EOs that would or could be like those of New York, California, Illinois, Michigan, heavy-handed socialist governors who have failed. This is supported by hospitals and other special interest groups that will not get the funding that they want. Government must get out of the way. This governor did a great job during this pandemic, and we are far ahead of other states, both freedom-loving and way more than the lockdown state, that even Governor Cuomo admitted that 66% of all cases were people staying at home. HB 76 would go hand in glove with the White House's goal to create a disaster where there is not one, all for power and control. Without the disaster or emergency order, the ability to get out vaccines has not diminished. If I remember correctly, the number fully vaccinated back on February 15th was within the mid or low 10,000. As of today's stats, we are now over 163,400 with both vaccines and over 405,700 total. That's 55% of the total population. We are over 63% of all seniors fully vaccinated, and that was in the single-digit percentages mid-February. Add to that the 59,700 that have had and are now immune towards herd immunity. Nothing in the news that I have heard that therapeutics are not available to the hospitals or pharmacies. All that said, we are in a recovery phase. Please do not step in front of that recovery. I oppose HB 76 because it is no longer needed. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony, sir. Next, we're going to Vicki Jo Kennedy in Juneau. Vicki Jo, can you hear us?
Yeah, I'm here. Hang on, I got a baby kitten holding on to my leg. Okay, can you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you, Vicki Jo. Put yourself on the record and welcome to Senate Finance. 2 minutes, please.
Now, yes, Vicki Jo Kennedy, and I'm still here in Juneau. And I am definitely still opposed. Now, to House Bill 76. And the reason being mainly is because we do have the governor that can, you know, if things get wacky again, he can put it out on his own. I know there was a big to-do over that. Or we can do it, or we can't. Well, he can if it needs to be done. But I don't think this state being held hostage by that, by suckling on that pig back in D.C. for $8 million worth of SNAP, or otherwise food stamps, it's ridiculous. I know where you can find $8 million right now. That would be for the salaries maintenance of a state-owned facility that is useless on Kodiak Island. It's called the Launch Complex, and you know I know that. So, but I just don't think we need it. I know all these people are worried about people's food, but I had someone take me to our local food bank on a Saturday morning just to see. There were two people in line. And yes, we have another distribution point in town. This one was out here in the valley. But I think people are getting it. I don't think there's anybody hungry. I think they're trying to protect jobs, as one person said. And that's sad, but it happens. So I am totally in opposition to it. It can be declared if it needs to be, if we have another flare-up, which we're working real hard not to do that with these vaccinations. So I appreciate the time you've taken to listen to us citizens out here, and good luck with your legislation.
Thank you, Ms. Kennedy. Next, we're going to go to Antioch, Mr. Herman Morgan. 2 minutes, sir.
Yeah, good morning. Me again, you guys are all tired of hearing me, and don't even know if you guys even listen to these people. You ask a lot of questions to these That's an interesting, so we know where you guys' hearts are. It's so sad when you got, you are destroying Alaska if you go along with this. You should ask them doctor questions. Did they change their testing mechanism? Because on January 20th, the WHO, World Health Organization, they said you're cycling too many times, a lot of false positives. That's why all these people, they say, had COVID. They asked them doctors if they changed their testing. Ask them. Because by not asking these important questions, you're destroying Alaska's economy. You should see their despair on them young people's faces. It's been investing them a high school play. They're all seniors and they can't play ball. A lot of them are staying home. Look at the big picture. Ask them doctors if they are giving up hydrochloroquine and ephemeris. Ask them specifically. And they mention, oh, if we don't have a disaster emergency, we can't have telehealth. That's a farce. They had telehealth even before this. They had snap benefits even before this. You know, you talk about liability. Some companies are facing lawsuits right now because they're saying that they have to be vaccinated. A lot of people, there are a lot of side effects on this untested vaccine. A few months ago, some of them were there at the Health and Social Services Committee meeting where that Pfizer vaccine, they say, do not give this to people who are pregnant or going to have sex. It says on page 132. And yet, you guys are still allowing that without informed consent on my native people. You never tell them what this vaccine can do to them. You're destroying Alaska, you guys. Wait till the lawsuits. Who's liable for that? Who's liable? Give people back their $5,000 dividend, and you wouldn't see all this hungry people and people begging for money, these companies. Accepting that federal corona relief money is affecting federal control. Globalism, it's affecting Alaska too. Biden, he said that mostly 16-year-old and older single men are being sent from the border to hotels in all 50 states. Hundreds of thousands of them coming in, 11 million more.
Mr. Morgan, could you wrap up your testimony,
please? You guys
got to
stop what you're doing. Please, you're destroying Alaska. We don't need this. Please, Bert, Lyman, Bill, ask questions to these people who are being destroyed.
Thank you, Mr. Morgan. Next, we're going to go to Christine Bigot in Willow. Christina, can you hear us?
Yes.
2 minutes, please, and put yourself on the record. Thank you.
My name is Christina Bigot. I am resident of Willow. I am very much opposed to HB 76. All I've heard this morning listening is groups and corporations and nonprofits wanting more and more government money to keep themselves afloat, while all of us private citizens are opposed because there is no pandemic. The numbers are low and people are recovering and masks are actually making people sicker. Have you guys heard of mask mouth? Dentists are complaining that people wearing masks constantly is making them sicker. There's no need for more money to take care of the vulnerable among us. Those people are being cared for. The rest of us need the freedom to move freely and operate freely and open businesses back up. I can't tell you how many businesses just here in the valley that have closed permanently because of the onerous restrictions that were placed, and they'll never be back. Those businesses are closed forever, and those people are out of jobs. Those people have lost their livelihoods, and they are the ones that are struggling because the government is so big and so bloated and in our business in every single way. And that's what I am opposed to this.
Thank you. We appreciate your testimony. Next, we're going to go to Christina Hutchinson, Kenai Peninsula. Christina.
It is Christine, Chairman. Thank you very much for the opportunity to speak. It is Christine Hutchison from the Kenai Peninsula, and I'm very pleased to hear the previous private citizen's testimony because they are all true. The governor has said many of the services that are supposed to be linked to this emergency declaration can and will continue without signing of this document or this legislation. So it's very important that this not pass, and the governor is supported in this. One of the issues with this legislation passing the legislature is that the smaller home rule cities can point to that and say, see, the state has an emergency declaration, so we need to have emergency declaration and lock down our entire large communities of the state. So it's really important that we set an example here and not pass this. The governor has said he doesn't need it, and I sincerely hope and pray the governor will veto it. Is that what we want to come out of this? On top of the legislature dealing with it, we do not hear the healthcare professionals mention ever the chances of contracting it and the chances of any serious complications or the chance of recovery. Every time I mention it, it turns out, or somebody will correct me, to say it's 99% recovery rate. Why do we not hear these health professionals mention this recovery rate? I want you to know that I am 72 years old. I have had no tests, and the minimal sickness I have been was exactly that, minimal. So why do we not hear these health professionals talk about these serious percentages of recovery and contracting? On top of all of this, where did the seasonal flu go? I don't understand. It's all gone. So is this the new seasonal flu? And with regard to the vaccinations and the so-called herd immunity that we will wonderfully get to, I am not willing to have an injection into my body of experimental materials. I've always understood that a vaccine was a part of the virus or the disease, similar to polio or diphtheria. That is not the case this time. So I do not want any kind of government regulation on what I need to do. Now, I know that the legislature hasn't mandated a vaccine passport, but I want to remind all of you, your job is to protect my rights, not to protect and develop rights for the mass majority. That is a little bit of federalism is right in there, and we need to stay focused on your authority and your responsibility to protect my rights.
Christine, could
we
you
have a real trend here?
Could you finish?
I will wrap it up.
Yeah, and
I will wrap this up to
if
say,
you have
please,
any other
please,
testimony,
please vote no
please
on this.
Send it into
Thank
the committee.
You very much.
Thank you very much. Next, we have staying on the Kenai Peninsula in Kenai, Tia Winger. Is that correct? And I apologize if I didn't pronounce your name correctly.
Yes, sir. Thank you. My name is Tia Winger, calling from the Kenai.
2 minutes. Thank you.
I'd like to thank you for the behalf of everybody be able to testify. I'm calling in opposition of expanding this declaration. As the last caller pointed out, the governor has said that he doesn't want this extended, that he doesn't need this extended, and I would hope that our bodies would be able to work with our governor as well as the people. Every dollar that we continue to take on this disaster declaration is $5 my great-grandchildren are going to have to pay back. We are already in a crisis with being in a deficit, and we're growing this. At this point, it's coming off as more greed. We need more, and we want more. We've had money from the federal government coming in for the past year, hand over fist. That money may not just be getting to the people because municipalities aren't putting it to the people to help them. Doesn't mean that we need to keep taking more and more money. This is going to, by expanding this, will hurt our tourism. It will hurt our small businesses. One thing that I haven't heard anybody talking about is these continued mandates and the shutting down of things is truly affecting our children. I'm a mother of three children that couldn't go to school this year. We had to homeschool because of the mask mandates and the fluctuation of a red light, yellow light, green light, just to go to school. We've been impacted. We can't play our sports. We have seen on the Kenai Peninsula the highest amount of suicide rates amongst our youth. And this is one that nobody has addressed. We have seen higher amounts of domestic violence during this. It's time to get past and move from a recovery phase to a resilience phase. All this is going to do is continue to be about money. We've heard people talking about SNAP benefits. These families are getting $800, $900 a month for a year. My grocery bill for a family of six is about $500. So there should have been more than enough to build a food supply at this point. Telemedical was another thing I heard people. That's been a complete failure for most. My dad has bladder cancer. They can't do telemedical for him, and his treatments have stopped. He hasn't had a cancer treatment in over a year because his doctor feels compromised and not safe.
Could you wrap up your comments, please? Thank you. You're over your 10 minutes.
So at this point, I would just like to say continuing to expand this declaration is just detrimental to the people. It's time to move into the recovery phase. I highly oppose this. It would be catastrophic to our state and the people, and I thank you for your time.
You're welcome. Thank you. Next, we're going to Quinnahawk. Willie Keppel, 2 minutes,
yes.
Please.
Thank you, Senators. I appreciate your time. I'm calling for myself from Quinnahawk. And I'd like to say, we don't need this. The people out here on the coast of the Bering Sea have had enough of the lockdown. Snowmobiles are traveling 200 miles one way just to go to Bethel and do some shopping. Our groceries, our airlines, everything is so tied up, sitting because of the complications of moving freight. It's unbelievable. City of Dillingham just turned in a petition yesterday, not the city, but people of Dillingham, with over 300 signatures to be rid of all COVID. The highest vote getter only had 240-some votes to get on the city council. It far surpassed the amount of votes taken to get on to a city council, yet the city council is trying to control way more people than what they ever actually had votes for. What we have going on out here is a travesty. You folks don't need the federal money. You've got it. All you need. You just refuse to do your jobs. I listened to Representative Zolkowski the other day in the House going, we're going to lose all these benefits. Poor rural Alaska. I took that clip and stood at the post office in Quinnahawk. I showed it to a lot of people. A lot of them voted for Tiffany. Every one of them was insulted. What do you mean we can't subsist for ourselves? What do you mean we can't feed ourselves? Turn us loose and let us go. That's what everybody wants. We pitched it out. Over 200 people, YKHC, Native Health Bethel, says has the COVID in a 10-day period. I call the governor's office. I call Senator Sullivan's office. Send out a National Guard health team. Let's re-verify these numbers. Not one comment ever back. No response. Yet nobody knew anybody other than two old people that were sick in the village. And one of them didn't even live here. You know, at the time he got it. Just get rid of this. The governor don't want it. The people don't want it. Thank you very much.
Yes, thank you for your comments. And next we're going to Francine Reuter in Anchorage. 2 minutes, please.
Yes, this is Francine Reuter, and I'm just representing myself. I've heard some really good comments, and I can just repeat some of them. The thing that stands out in my mind the most is one of the nonprofits saying, you know, it's the state's responsibility for our safety. I'm appalled at that. At what point did that happen? No, we are responsible for ourselves. And that is not government's role, not in the United States of America. Please, do not continue HB 76. Vitamin D, look it up. We should be talking about vitamin D. The research is there, and it's been there for decades. And we're talking about other things that does not hold up in research and only causes harm. And I am appalled at what we've done to our state, appalled. And I do not know how this happened. My grandparents and great-grandparents drove the Alaska Highway in 1948. They did not come to the state to have the state take care of them. They came here to take care of themselves. What has happened to us? I'm done.
Thank you for your testimony. Max Rooney in Anchorage. Please, Max, put yourself on the record in 2 minutes, please.
Hi, my name is Max Romy. Thanks so much for the opportunity to call in support of extending the emergency declaration. I'm a filmmaker. I work with a lot of international brands, and I can't get people to come to Alaska. Based on the headlines, they say no way what's going on there. And I would just like to encourage the responsible choice to extend the emergency declaration so that we can get the headlines back to the amazing wild Alaska that we all know, instead of the way that the legislation or the governor is turning down emergency funding that could have helped Alaskans. I think we need to take this seriously, and nothing will scare people away and make my job harder than more headlines about a new spike or the way that Alaskans are not supported or have their support turned down for political reasons. I'd really appreciate if this emergency declaration could be passed and we could get back to the just exciting, wild Alaska that we all know and love. Thanks.
Thank you for your testimony. It appears we have no one else for public testimony, so testimony is closed. My intention is to hear and hold the bill, and so with the public testimony, invited testimony being completed, that's exactly what we're going to do, and we're going to set the bill aside. Reminder, the amendment deadline for HB 76 is Thursday, April 1 at 5 p.m. So the deadline is, again, Thursday, April 1st at 5 p.m. Tomorrow's meeting, March 31st, is on for 9 a.m. On the agenda is the Alaska economy with the Department of Labor and ICER. And we're going to hear from the Research and Analysis Department of the Department of Labor and the university. So Senator Stedman will have the gavel tomorrow at 9 a.m. We are adjourned at 10:10.